Hello, and welcome to Epochs. Last time I said once I'd finished speaking to you all about the life of Leonardo and Michelangelo, I'd do a whistle-stop tour of the entire Medici family, about 300 years worth of history, and I will do that. But before I do, there's one other very, very interesting life that I wanted to talk to you all about, and that is the life of Girolamo Savonarola, a firebrand monk of Florence. And I wanted to talk to you all about that just because it's a really important interregnum in the story of the Medici, an interruption, one of the few interruptions actually, in the rule of the Medici family in Florence. This one is particularly interesting, I think, the highs and lows. So if you'll allow me, I'll tell you about the rise and fall of Savonarola. So first of all, let me take you to a moment in time, the 7th of February, 1497, late afternoon, early evening, in the main square of Florence, the Piazza della Signoria. And there was constructed a giant bonfire, 60 feet high by all accounts, over 200 feet long, 60 feet high, a giant, giant fire. And the people of Florence, bear in mind that's where the Renaissance itself had flourished, the home, the seat of great works of art, of opulence, and the rebirth of classicism, the rebirth of really what artistic taste really means. The people there were throwing on this bonfire great works of art, great busts, drawings by Michelangelo and Leonardo, paintings by Botticelli, all sorts of things, all their fineries were being thrown on this fire and burnt to cinders. And overlooking it all was the fiery monk, Savonarola. You can only imagine he was smiling, perhaps maniacally laughing. We don't know if he was doing that. Rubbing his hands in glee. And because it was exactly what he wanted to see. Now, only a few years later, the people of Florence decided to change their minds again. They went back to how they were before, i.e. kind of liking or glorying in art and beauty and extravagance and things. So it begs the question, why did they go mad for a while? Why did they sort of lose their minds? What had this Savonarola done? What in all the world had he said to them to make this extraordinary event happen? And in fact, there was more than one of these bonfires. The bonfire of the vanities, if you had sort of extreme ornamentation or nice things. Like you said that they were vanities. If you wore jewels and had paintings, you owned vanities. So it's a bonfire of the vanities. They're setting fire to all their good stuff. So before I get into the details of exactly what Savonarola did and said and who he was, and these events are taking place in the 1490s, I need to talk to you a little bit about the history of Florence itself. Obviously, we've gone through a bit of it when we talked about Leonardo and Michelangelo. But if I give you a bit more. So Florence had been one of the great mercantile republics of the Middle Ages. No one knows exactly when and how Florence was founded. Some say it was a Roman, ancient Roman military camp. Julius Caesar himself made a camp there at one point. And there's all sorts of stories about exactly how it started, kind of lost in the mists of time. But by the 12th century, or 13th century certainly, Florence had emerged as one of the great trading posts in Italy, where trade had exploded in the early Middle Ages, coming from Constantinople, Byzantium, coming all sorts of trade coming from the east through into Europe central and southern and even into Western Europe. With the fall of the Western Roman Empire, city-states or towns grew up as mercantile centres, places where you can trade. Venice was a great one. Venice had also, by the 12th and 13th century, built a giant navy. They sort of commanded the Mediterranean Sea in some ways. Rome itself, though having been sacked many times, was still extremely powerful and important in and of itself. But Florence was emerging as one of these places where a merchant could get things done, that guilds, minor and major guilds, taken over from what would have been a nobility or a lordship or a duke or a count or something like that. The Florentine Republic had a sort of its own way of doing things. What they decided, what they had, in the 12th and 13th century and further on, but it became a bit more meaningless. But to begin with, they had a council of nine, sort of as an executive body, a committee of nine men. But the idea was that you only held office for 2 months and then swap them out with nine new guys. And so they got through quite a lot of people. So it's not a direct democracy, but a lot of people got to have a say in how Florence was governed. There are downsides, of course, to having such a short term, such a short tenure. You couldn't necessarily always carry through sort of a giant project that needed to last years. But they would have other committees. They would have a committee of 10 that are in charge of war, all things military, or a committee of 6 that was specifically charged with dealing with sort of commerce issues. And that's how they did it. And it seemed to work relatively well for a while. Florence certainly flourished. But the problem with republics often, and I've talked about this with Stelios and Karl a number of times, is that they're usually relatively easy to subvert. So if you're just simply rich enough, you can essentially buy the men that are going to be in these committees to do what you want. And you don't even have to sit on the committee yourself. You just give the men that are going to, you either threaten them with things or you bribe them. You give them lots of money and nice things, or at least promise them nice things and lots of money. And then they do your bidding. And well, that is what happened with Florence, because among other things, Florence became famous for its bankers. More than one family became moneylenders and bankers. And the most famous one of all is the Medici family. And by the time of the mid-15th century, the Medici family had rose to become so rich through their banking enterprises that they were among the richest people in Italy or in Europe or perhaps in the world. Some have said that if you adjust for inflation, they would have been billionaires. Among the richest people ever to have lived. Just fantastic amounts of money. And in the end, Cosimo de' Medici, Cosimo the Elder, not Cosimo the First, who's much later, that's during the age of Galileo Galilei, but the earlier Cosimo, Cosimo the Elder, in the mid-15th century, he'd become so powerful that he didn't need to actually hold office in Florence. He just had de facto power. His group of clients, all the men that sort of owed him favours, like a godfather, were like all the leading men of Florence, essentially, or nearly all of them, certainly a giant faction of them. And at any given time, more or less, they controlled these great committees of state. And so, by proxy, the Medici family sort of controlled Florence. Now, that isn't really in the spirit of a republic, is it? Now, lots of people were happy with it, happy to be a client of the Medici, to be a Medici man, help you out. But lots of people sort of hated it and thought it was always, as I say, not in the spirit of a republic. So the Medici family were both deeply loved and admired on one hand, and by a whole group of other people, deeply loathed. And so by the time Cosimo passed away, all his estates and influence and power, if you like, passed to Piero, who didn't last very long. And then it passes to Lorenzo the Magnificent, Lorenzo the Great, who I did talk about a fair bit during the videos on Michelangelo and Leonardo. And he was the one who was attacked in the great cathedral, the Duomo, and his brother was murdered, and Lorenzo himself was wounded but survived. And then after that, they did away with all their enemies, the Pazzi family. And from that point on, Lorenzo was really, in all but name, the king, if you like, of Florence. Now, it's in this period, or towards the end of the reign, in inverted commas, of Lorenzo the Magnificent, that Savonarola comes onto the scene. Now, Savonarola was a very, very, very serious individual. Everything he did and said was extremely serious. There's no room for any mucking about in the mind, in the world view of Savonarola. And he, along with lots of people, because he garnered a genuine following of his own, lots of people agreed with him and his worldview. A lot of them weren't happy with the way the world was going. They weren't happy with the Renaissance. They weren't happy with people like Lorenzo. They saw him as impious, as ungodly, unchristian, that there was something profoundly wrong with the Renaissance, with art, with the art, having nudes, doing paintings of nudes, or making sculptures that were nude, for example. God wouldn't like such a thing. Botticelli did paintings The Venus is a famous one. That's sort of pornographic, sort of terribly wrong. And all art should only really be in veneration to God. So let's talk a little bit about the times again. So if we're talking about the 1490s, Lorenzo dies in 1492. So in the preceding generation or so, a couple of generations, let's see what happens. The papacy, the Catholic Church, had experienced or had been experiencing for a couple of centuries a decline in authority. They might have been becoming more powerful in temporal terms, becoming like actual princes with armies, the papal army and things. They might be becoming more powerful and ever richer. But in terms of sort of spiritual authority, they'd been declining. And lots of people thought, well, they were losing faith, really, in the papacy itself. When Constantinople fell to the Turk in 1453, in the medieval worldview, late medieval worldview, that was a sign from the heavens, that was a sign from God. If you lose Constantinople, just like in a much earlier epoch, in the 11th, 12th century, if you lose Jerusalem, God wants it that way and you're being punished. You're being punished for being bad, for not being religious enough, for not having enough faith and things. So the fall of Constantinople sort of shook the Western European world in all sorts of ways. And the Turk was pushing on into Central and Southern Europe, pushing up as far as Venice even. And then there's the plague, the Black Death. I've said before a number of times that it's difficult to really understand how seismic the Black Death was. The Black Death hit Italy in 1447. It didn't hit England till 48, 49, but it hit Venice first, but then all of Italy by 1447. Venice lost half its population, we think. Probably something like half of all the people, men, women and children, regardless of how rich or poor you are, died in one summer, sort of, in one year. Again, to the medieval mind, you're very, very, very deliberately being punished by God for being bad. Like the flood, like in the story of Noah. You know, the biblical God does that to men sometimes as a punishment. Combine that with the popes and the papacy in the 15th century were getting increasingly more venal and corrupt. There's the crime of simony, named after Simon Magus, that you sell ecclesiastical favours or positions within the church. They're sold to the highest bidder. That's a crime. That's sort of a religious crime. The papacy was guilty of that, of indulgences. It gets much worse in the period after Savonarola, when the Medicis themselves become popes, Leo X and Clement VII. The indulgences thing went through the roof, but it was already happening. And again, to a lot of people, that's just all kinds of wrong. So there's the Black Death, there's the fall of Constantinople, and there's just the general decline in sort of the spiritual quality of the popes sitting in Rome. And again, the broader trend is that it's a couple of hundred years long. So there'd been people like John Wycliffe, an Englishman, who long before Martin Luther, a couple of hundred years, 150 odd years before Martin Luther, had pointed this out. There's something terribly wrong at the heart of Rome and the papacy and Orthodox Catholicism. It's not being conducted correctly. Should we even have popes? Should we even have stained glass windows? Should we have icons of any type? What are we doing, really, worshipping saints and the Virgin Mary? Is that right? You know, asking all these questions. In other words, proto-early Protestants. So again, to put Savonarola in his context, it's before Martin Luther. Martin Luther doesn't pin his list of concerns to the church door in Wittenberg until 1517. So that's, you know, nearly 20 odd years after the events of Savonarola's rise and fall. So that hasn't happened yet. Hardline Protestantism hasn't happened. But there'd been people like John Wycliffe or John Hus, Jan Hus, who in 1415 was finally burnt at the stake for asking such questions at the Council of Constance. Oh, another thing, just an example of how the papacy, there seemed to be something wrong there. Earlier in the 15th century, there had been anti-popes running around. There were two, or at one point even three popes running around, all claiming they're the divinely ordained pope. You know, how can that be? There can only be one vicar of Christ on earth at any one given time, surely. So what are you guys doing claiming there's two or even three of them? You've got it wrong. Something's gone wrong. There's that feeling. And anyway, Savonarola was one of these guys. He was a monk. He was a Dominican monk. And the Dominicans, as well as the Franciscans, were what they called a mendicant or a mendicant order. And what that is monks that would, itinerant monks, go around from place to place, or sometimes stay in a monastery, but often go around from place to place, preaching, and preaching sort of poverty. You know, St. Francis of Assisi himself basically owned nothing. He'd own a robe, you know, a garment of some type, a rope for around his waist, and maybe a bowl. And that's it. Certainly no money. Certainly no jewels or gold or, you know, a bejeweled bowl made out of gold or anything. No. No, he lived in absolute poverty. And that's what sort of a mendicant... Mendicant means to be like a beggar, really. And it goes back to sort of the... looking at what was written in the Bible in the first place. The great podcaster Dan Carlin put it quite well when he talked about Luther one time and the Protestants. He said that when you read the Gospels, when you read the four books that tell you about the life of Jesus of Nazareth, when you read it for yourself, rather than just listening to what a priest tells you it says in Latin, once it's in the vernacular, you can read it in your own language. Jesus looks a lot like a poor person. He hangs around with poor people, with beggars, with the homeless, even prostitutes. And he helps them out, the dirty, the downtrodden. You know, he's a champion for the poor and downtrodden people of the world. And so that's what sort of mendicant orders were about, sort of getting back to that original thing, that, you know, the meek. And when you look at the papacy, where they've got, you know, giant cathedrals, giant monumental piles of stone, and they're filled with gold and silver and gems, and the Pope wears a giant hat that's covered in gems, and he's sort of, one way or another, sort of extorting money out of people all over the world, so that him and his entourage can be covered in silks and gold and things. None of that's in the Gospels. Jesus didn't talk about that sort of thing. Why are we doing that? Perhaps the church has lost its way, in a very profound sense, lost its way. Are the popes even sort of antichrists? They've not just got it a bit wrong, they've got it completely wrong, and they're evil. So that's where someone like Savonarola is coming from. So a little bit then about Savonarola and his life. He came from just a fairly normal family. They had a bit of money. They were neither complete beggars nor particularly rich, but they aspired for their children. He was the third son, I believe, the third child in the family. They at least aspired for them to try and do better in life. And so they wanted to train him as a doctor. But it seems that the Savonarola from quite early in his life was less interested in anatomy and more interested in reading St. Thomas Aquinas, i.e. the spiritual life, theology. He was much more interested in that. And so when he was old enough and left home, he went and joined a Dominican monastery, a convent. And there's letters, because quite a lot survives about Savonarola, lots of his letters and treatises he wrote. He wrote about the ruin of the papacy, the ruin of Italy, the ruin of the world. He's quite apocalyptic. You know, he said that rapture was coming, the kingdom of Christ was coming to earth soon, any day, sort of thing. You better be ready for it. And his parents would write to him and say, you know, we're a bit disappointed, really, because although it's sort of spiritually or morally good to be a monk, you know, you're not really going to become very, you're never going to become important, and you're certainly not going to make any money whatsoever. Is that in your best interest? Is that in the best interest of our family? We'd hoped maybe you'd seen the error of your ways and maybe not be a Dominican monk, maybe not be a Dominican friar. And to get the measure of the man, he wrote back to them saying, so this is to his own parents, he said, "You are my sworn enemies and foes of virtue. Get ye behind me, all those who work evil." So he's a serious individual, serious character. He knows his own mind. And if you don't agree with him, you're evil. Quite often that's sort of how it's phrased. Quite often that's the framing of it in his own mind. Savonarola just seemed to be disgusted with the decadence in the world around him. And when he moved to Bologna, he wrote this, or he said this. He said, quote, "To be a man here, you must defile your mouth with the most filthy, brutal and tremendous blasphemies. If you study the good arts, you are considered a dreamer. If you live chastely and modestly, you are a fool. If you are pious, a hypocrite. If you believe in God, an imbecile." And, you know, he just would not have that. He would do anything and everything in his power to rail against it with every ounce of energy in his body. And he beat himself up about it. I mean, quite literally, flagellation, the idea of flogging yourself. If he had many possessions, one of them at least would be a type of flail to flog his own back. He said, "I must struggle cruelly to keep the demon from leaping upon my back." He thought that the Italy of the Renaissance, that Florence in the mid to late 15th century, was a terrible thing. He thought that the reign of the Antichrist had come, that Satan had captured the world, and that soon Christ would appear to begin his earthly rule, that rapture would come, and that you'd all be judged, and that you need to be ready for it, that divine vengeance would engulf all the tyrants, adulterers, and atheists. And as a younger man in his 20s, he would preach, but they weren't all that popular. He seemed to over-egg it. That's what the accounts say about him. When he first started, his demagoguery, his speaking in public, was too much, too strong for people. They didn't really like it, and his style wasn't florid, or it didn't flow, or it was just too authoritarian, even for people that might be ready to hear it. And so he spent 5 or 6 years in a monastery where we don't really know exactly what he did in those years, but what is evident is that after that period ended and he started preaching again, his message was received much, much better. He seemed to have changed his style in some ways, and so he garnered a following quite quickly, and within a space of just a few years after that, was extremely popular, one of the most popular preachers in all of central Italy. Or eventually he was posted to St. Mark's in Florence, not St. Mark's in Venice, but St. Mark's in Florence, where apparently his sermons, his preachings, was absolutely loved. It seems that maybe he tapped into the zeitgeist of the times, that people were ready to hear that, that lots of people did think, oh, maybe the Renaissance in Florence anyway had gone a bit too far. Maybe someone like Lorenzo Medici, maybe it wasn't right that he was sort of this de facto king that only really ruled, in inverted commas, through money. Like, is that really the best thing? Do we like that? Is it okay that Botticelli keeps painting semi-pornographic things that aren't necessarily about Christianity? They're pictures that they're like pagan pictures with like Venus in it or something. Is that right? We always used to have art sort of in maybe the Byzantine style, where in the art people were fairly emotionless and it was purely about the veneration of God and Christ. But now people like Giotto and Botticelli, they were painting people with emotions, with like grief on their face or love in their eyes. Is that right? I'm not sure that's right. We should probably dial that down a bit. And the great men of the city, least of all the Medicis themselves, is it right or fair that they live in palaces and they've got endless money? Like I say, they'll be the equivalent of billionaires, multi-billionaires. That's not right. That's not what Jesus talked about. They're not being very Christian, are they? We don't like it. And so someone like Savonarola turns up and he's got an audience. And a lot of what he talked about was the denunciation of immorality and prophecies of doom and calling for repentance. One of the things in Florence is it seems to be a fairly, how shall I say, licentious culture, libidinous. Seems to be lots of prostitutes and homosexuality. I mean, it was illegal to be homosexual, but you could sort, you could get away with it. There's certain times, certain places, like in Britain, it's Brighton. It's got a reputation for being gay. Perhaps in America, it's San Francisco, or used to be San Francisco. In Italy, in the 15th century, it was Florence. Well, someone like Savonarola says, you shouldn't be a prostitute. We can't have prostitutes. We can't have homosexuality, sodomy. Can't do it. You can't have nice things. You shouldn't own a painting that shows a semi-nude person. You shouldn't have jewels. You shouldn't have gold things. It's wrong. It's morally wrong. Here's a great quote. Savonarola said to his flock. He said, quote, "Ye women who glory in ornaments, your hair, your hands, I tell you, you are all ugly. Would you see true beauty? Look at the pious man or woman in whom spirit dominates matter. See him when he prays, when a ray of the divine beauty glows upon him when his prayer is ended. You will see the beauty of God shining in his face. You will behold it as though it were the face of an angel." But Savonarola went a bit above and beyond just the spiritual. He also talked about politics as well. And like Jesus, was a champion for poor people, essentially, the downtrodden in society. And he saw sort of the massive disparity in wealth between the richest and the poorest. And he said, "In these days, there is no grace, no gift of the Holy Spirit that may not be brought or sold." Again, talking about simony there. "On the other hand, the poor are oppressed by grievous burdens, and when they are called to pay sums beyond their means, the rich cry unto them, give me the rest." Now, you can only imagine that if you're poor and oppressed, which of course many were, that's music to your ears, right? I'm going to follow this guy. He's going to stand up for me. And hopefully, if the powers that be ever listen, hopefully will better my lot in life, or the lot of my children or grandchildren. I'm going to follow this guy. Now, one other thing just to remind you about the Black Death, where so many people had died, that the value of labour had gone up. Whereas before the Black Death, various forms of indentured servitude, serfdom, types of slavery, were much more common than afterwards. People could, labourers or workers or peasants, could now demand a bit more for their labour, you know, because labour was in demand. So I won't just work for you because I have to, because you've got a giant labour pool to pick from. No, you need me more than I need you, so pay me more, or give me more benefits at least. Don't treat me as a chattel. Don't treat me as I'm just a cattle or sheep or something. I'm not merely your possession. You're going to have to actually pay me and treat me with some dignity. That's another thing to mention about the dignity of man. That by the 15th century, or by the Protestant Reformation, or just before, there's the rise of what's called humanism. And I talked about a bit about that in the Michelangelo one, didn't I? There's all different types of humanism. But in this period, we're talking about really a religious or a biblical stripe of humanism. That might seem weird, you know, like a biblical humanism. But still, nonetheless, this concept that in the earlier Middle Ages, maybe in the Gothic period, you might say, the centre of thought, the centre of your worldview was God, was the heavens. You build giant cathedrals or churches with giant spires pointing straight towards heaven. And you go inside and you're reminded that you're a tiny speck in God's plan. And you're a peasant because God wants it that way. It's divinely ordained to be that way. And what you think and how you feel doesn't really matter. Again, like those emotionless faces of the stylized Byzantine art. The most important thing isn't men, it's God. Well, by the 15th century, certainly, there was this advent of what you would call a type of still Catholic humanism, where they were saying things like, no, wait, why don't we build chapels or churches that are on the human scale, especially in Florence? In fact, it started in Florence. I don't necessarily need this giant cathedral. Why not have just a chapel that's on the human scale? Why not have art which depicts actual human emotions? So I did, like in Leonardo and Michelangelo, for example. Well, is the human body just a completely divine mechanism which you could never understand and don't try? Or is it actually, if the human mind can understand it, maybe it is just a mechanism, maybe it is just a machine, the greatest of all machines, but isn't the human body like a machine? And if we dissect it and look closely enough, actually we can understand it. Again, all this stuff, that thought, that strain of thought explodes in Florence. You know, maybe there's nothing we can't do. Maybe there's almost nothing we can't do. Maybe we can build ships that can sail across an endless ocean. Maybe we can build machines that are like automatons that can move on their own, like Leonardo da Vinci. Maybe I can create a helicopter thing. Maybe I can create a diving suit. This idea that the sky's the limit, and the only thing that holds you back, the only thing that holds back the mind, the imagination of men, is themselves. You don't need to be constrained by God, necessarily. But they're thinking, maybe we don't just have to do exactly what the papacy says, especially if it's sort of flagrantly wrong or unfair. No, wait a minute, maybe I can make up my own mind of what's right and wrong. I can read the Bible for myself. Well, if you could read Latin. Again, it hadn't been translated into the vernacular until Luther, a bit later, not too long from now. But of course, Savonarola could read it in the Latin. You know, why do I have to do this latest thing the Pope has suddenly decided? And so, anyway, the Pope at this point is Alexander VI, who is Rodrigo Borgia. Now, someone like Savonarola, right off the bat, is going to have all sorts of problems with Rodrigo Borgia. He's got children, you know, Cesare Borgia and Lucrezia Borgia, and he acts like a prince, a warlord, in all sorts of ways. So no, I'm not necessarily going to do exactly what the Pope wants or tells me. You know, that's a sea change. That's an important thing. And Savonarola just pours scorn on the world around him. He's not afraid. He's sort of politically fearless. He's not afraid to just say exactly what he thinks. You know, he says that Florence has become a den of thieves and that it shall be smitten down. Now, right away, you would think that someone like Lorenzo Medici, effectively the ruler of Florence, might see that as just, you know, sedition or treason or something, and just have him arrested and killed or exiled or in any way just shut down and shut up. But he had such a following that it didn't seem, well, Lorenzo didn't do that. And in fact, and you might think this is counterintuitive, but in fact, Lorenzo listened to him quite a lot and, yeah, didn't close him down at all. Allowed him to do sermons, eventually in the cathedral, the giant Duomo Cathedral in Florence. And it was nearly always packed. And Savonarola criticised bankers as well, which the Medici were. They were the example par excellence of bankers. And he would say that banking, you know, charging interest for things and just accruing giant amounts of money was unlawful, it was unjust. That Florence was, that the Medici had corrupted the city, and that usury or the charging of interest is sinful in and of itself. I mean, it says that in the Bible, right? That the Medici had imperiled the souls of everybody, that the Medici were whores, and that Christ hates them. You know, he's pulling no punches, pulling absolutely no punches. It really is surprising that Lorenzo sort of allowed it to go on. Maybe it was one of those things. Historians have always wondered, exactly why did Lorenzo allow that to go on? Well, on one level, he sort of clearly, on some level, agreed with that. Must have felt bad about it in some ways. Also, maybe Savonarola was so powerful or so widely loved that, you know, if you create a martyr out of someone, you amplify their voice or their message even more. You know, the Streisand effect. Nevertheless, Lorenzo did try some countermeasures. He tried to sort of placate the people, because towards the end of Lorenzo's life, he realised that sort of the tide of public opinion was turning against him. It was a golden age in Florence, the reign, in inverted commas, of Lorenzo the Magnificent. It was a golden age in all sorts of ways. And lots of people very much enjoyed it and enjoyed themselves. But there was a faction of the people which hated it, and he could see sort of that they were not an insignificant faction of the people. So he tried to sort of placate them with even more sort of festivals and shows, and in a way, a type of collective bribery to get them on side. And that sort of backfired often. They hated him even more. It certainly didn't work on Savonarola. He just called it, it was just a pagan thing to do, having all these sort of fairly non-Christian festivals and things. It was just a pagan thing to do. It was idolatrous. Lorenzo tries to quite literally directly bribe Savonarola by sending him all sorts of gifts and money. That's not going to work for a moment on Savonarola. He cannot be bought. He's that type of person. He just sends them back. He's just not interested, not for one second. Lorenzo tries to reason with him, sends him letters and things saying, come on, let's come to some sort of agreement. You know, what you're saying is quite hard line, and I'm not crazy. I'm not actually a tyrant. Look, I'm not arresting you. I'm not killing you or your followers. Come on, let's talk. But Savonarola is not really interested in that either. He just replies and says, look, Lorenzo, look inside your own soul. That's all I can tell you. That's all I've got for you. It's up to you. That's it. Full stop. Your move. Another thing Lorenzo tries to do is sort of gather together a small cadre of countermeasures, of other preachers, of other demagogues, or other monks that are good at talking and whipping up crowds, but with a counter message to Savonarola's, saying, look, this guy's going too far. Come on, this stuff, what Savonarola's saying, is going to lead to civil unrest. Do you really all want to live like beggars? Is that what you really want? And so there was some sort of battle of ideas for a while, but Savonarola wins it. Him and his faction, his side and his followers ultimately win that battle of wills. But even that doesn't seem like it's enough for Savonarola, because he then always had really, but at this point sort of starts dialing up his criticism directly of the Pope and the papacy and Rome, particularly their riches, that they have golden and bejeweled mitres and chalices, and that the ancient church or the ministry of Christ himself had no such things, wouldn't dream of having such things. So you've gone wrong there, Rodrigo Borgia, Pope Alexander VI. You're doing it wrong. And so, as I say, eventually Lorenzo dies. He wasn't all that old when he died in 1492. And on his deathbed, this speaks volumes about how Lorenzo viewed Savonarola, is that on his deathbed, instead of sending for any other preacher or monk or priest or anything like that to give his final confession, as every good Catholic had to, he sends for Savonarola. Bit of an odd choice, really, there, because he's his political enemy. There's no doubt about that. But he sends for Savonarola. I guess his thinking was, most people think, that Lorenzo the Magnificent's thinking was that if I can give my confession to the ultra-hardline Savonarola, then I will truly be forgiven. And so Savonarola takes his confession and doesn't accept it. Says, no, that's not good enough. That's not a true confession. I damn you, Lorenzo. I damn your soul. Well, it doesn't get any more hardline than that, really. And Lorenzo, you can only imagine, was aghast at such a thing. But it just shows you how sort of severe Savonarola was and unbending. He had a line in the sand, and he would not cross it for anyone or anything. So a few things happen quite quickly after Lorenzo the Magnificent dies. His estates and his power, in every real sense, passes to the next in line in the Medici clan, Piero Medici, who's only 20 years old. And he's known as Piero the Unfortunate or Piero the Unlucky, because just his time on the stage of history was just kind of unlucky. He was doomed. He has a bad roll of the dice. Will Durant describes the personality of Piero the Unlucky as, quote, having a violent temper, a middling mind, a vacillating will, and admirable intentions. But the King of France invades Italy. Charles VIII, King of France, himself very young, only about 24, wants to have a war with Naples, the Kingdom of Naples. The Kingdom of Naples controlled all of southern Italy. So in order to get to southern Naples, he doesn't want to do it via sea, via a navy. So he crosses a great army, one of the greatest armies to ever cross the Alps since ancient times, joins up with Milan, goes down through sort of central Italy, through Florence, and through Rome, down to Naples, and does invade Naples. So another moment in time, another image I can try and paint for you. It was on the 17th of November, 1494. So Lorenzo the Magnificent has been dead for 2 years now, and Piero the Unlucky has ruled, in inverted commas, weekly for about 2 years. The King of France and his armies enter Florence against the will of the Florentines. Now, the Florentines had an army, but it was nowhere big enough to even hope to put up a resistance to King Charles VIII's grand French army, coalition of armies, actually. So they basically let him in. Yeah, there's no point really getting the small army you've got massacred for the sake of it. So Piero the Unlucky lets King Charles and a bunch of his army in. And at that point, Charles VIII becomes very haughty and starts demanding all sorts of things. And Piero just completely gives in to them all, just says, yeah, whatever you want, you know, I can't do anything about it. But Savonarola sort of stands firm and says, no, all the people of the city will start attacking you right now. I mean, right now, if you don't start treating us with a little bit of respect. And where King Charles had entered with only a handful, a small contingent, the King of France loses his nerve a bit. Savonarola sort of called his bluff. And anyway, King Charles only ever wanted to get to Naples. So instead of getting bogged down in Florence, he continues on to Naples. But at that point, Piero the Unlucky, his power base, people's confidence in him, the people of Florence, their confidence in him completely collapses. And him and his faction are quite physically run out of the city. The Medici palaces and gardens are ransacked by the people of Florence. And that's sort of the end of Piero the Unlucky, because within a few months or a year or two, he dies in an accident, some sort of a freak boating accident. He's drowned in some way, if I recall rightly. But he just dies, and that's it. He's obviously not on the stage of history anymore. So, yeah, looking back on him, he is sort of unfortunate or unlucky, but also brought it upon himself in some ways. He was weak. Could have tried to stand up for himself and Florence a bit more than he did. But anyway, once the King of France has done his thing in Naples and gone back through Italy and back up to France, there's now a power vacuum in Florence, where there'd been a republic for a few hundred years before the Medici started dominating everything. They've still got some of the infrastructure, some of the political structure in place to be a republic. But when the Medici family sort of, you know, in general terms, sort of overnight have disappeared, there's this power vacuum, and they try and make a new constitution. Like I say, they'd always had that thing where there'd been sort of an executive of nine and then another committee to do with war. Anyway, they make a new constitution where there's going to be a council of 20, but it all falls apart quite quickly. And they decide they're going to sort of base their new constitution around what Venice was doing, because Venice was very powerful and successful at this stage in history. They're going to have sort of a grand council of 3,000 men, which is a big chunk of the, sort of the adult male population. And they'll have these smaller committees, one of 10, one of 12, one of 8, for all these different things. They'll have a gonfaloniere, sort of a leader, a type of leader, a decider, not much more than a decider, but they'll have some sort of leader. But underneath it all, Savonarola and his preachings are there. And a lot of the de facto day-to-day power, or who gets to say that the way the winds are going, it's Savonarola. He holds a lot of power, de facto power. And so he steps into this power vacuum, and his moralising goes on and on and on, and is more and more popular. And he says things like, if you desire a good government, you must restore it to God. He said things like, look, Florence has got an invisible king, Jesus Christ. That's all you need to know. We're going to create, we've got the chance here to create a sort of utopian theocracy. If you follow me and my preachings and the small amount of secular organisation that's going on, we can become great. We can become, if you want riches, we'll have riches beyond measure if you just follow me and what I'm saying and the right way. Stop following what the Pope says. Stop following whatever the Medici were telling you. I know the best thing for us to do, so just follow me. He said, quote, O Florence, then shall ye be rich with spiritual and temporal wealth, thou wilt achieve the reformation of Rome, of Italy, of all countries. The wings of thine greatness shall spread over the world. He's saying basically, under my leadership, we're going to reform Rome. I mean, that's heresy right there. We're going to reform Rome, supersede Rome, supersede all Christianity is what he's saying, really, with my view of it, my version of it. And then that will dominate, eventually will dominate our way of doing things, will dominate all the countries, the whole world. I'm going to create a new golden age for Florence. Florence will be a new Jerusalem. There will be a new Cyrus to set us free. Well, Cyrus freed the Jews in scriptural times, biblical times. There's going to be a new golden age. It's going to be so much better than what the Medici gave us. It's going to be real. It's going to be like religiously and spiritually correct this time. And inevitably, it's so great that we're going to dominate the whole world with it. The Florence will become the new Jerusalem, the new centre of the world, spiritually and in real terms, in temporal sense. So for a while at least, not all that long, about a year or two, it looks like Savonarola is sort of riding higher, that he is the de facto leader of Florence. Not any of these committees, not the Grand Council, not the Gonfalonier or anything, but Savonarola. However, firebrands like that, it's impossible not to garner a whole bunch of enemies as well. For the number of people you convert to your side that follow you with zeal, you're going to create a lot of enemies as well. And that's what he did. And there was all sorts of factions that were against him. The old banking class, the Medici still had followers and other rich noble families, not just the Medici. They all had followers. People that wanted to still follow the Pope and the papacy, plenty of those. Plenty of other stripes of religious people who just didn't like exactly what Savonarola was saying, just didn't agree with him exactly. Either thought he was being way too harsh, or some of them even thought he wasn't being harsh enough. He's got a lot of enemies, a lot of rich and powerful enemies as well. He might have a lot of the sort of downtrodden normal people or even middle classes on his side, but a lot of the rich and powerful and influential people, they ended up sort of clubbing together in all sorts of ways as a counterculture against what Savonarola was doing. And they had been biding their time, really, sort of getting together to sort of create a half-decent faction against his, to be fair, very strong faction. You know, they thought, Savonarola's faction, thought they had righteousness on their side. So that's strong, isn't it? You need to be ready before you can take something like that on, if you can stand any chance of success. And they had names for each other. The enemies of Savonarola called that whole faction, they often called them weepers or the weepers, because quite often people were brought to tears by Savonarola's sermons. Sometimes they were called the snivellers, or the hypocrites, or the prayer munchers. That's a funny one. Obviously, it's in translation from medieval Italian. And Savonarola's faction would call their enemies, political enemies, the lukewarms, or sometimes the mad dogs. So two big factions were forming, or had formed, in Florence. And they were both vying for control of the various offices of state. And at one point in 1496, the mad dogs, i.e. the enemies of Savonarola, got their pick for Gonfalonier into office. And he sort of immediately calls out Savonarola and says, wait a minute, you've gone way too far. Come on, you've gone way too far. You're saying that everything you tell us in your sermons, in your preaching, has come directly from God. Isn't that heresy? Who are you to say you can commune directly with God? Isn't that blasphemous? We need you to prove that you're actually in communication with God, which of course he couldn't do. So Savonarola is chastened a bit by that there's sort of a little dip in his power at that point, because he's being asked to submit impossible evidence. And another thing which dents Savonarola's authority or power is that during his period of more or less being in control, in an indirect way, is that Florence as a city is having a bit of a bad time of it. Its coffers, its funds have run out. Even before Piero the Unlucky was chucked out, the Medici bank had had all sorts of problems, and there wasn't an endless amount of money anymore. And certainly after the Medici are gone, Florence isn't rolling in money anymore, and they've sort of run out of money, and even there's sort of famine is starting to happen. Now, if Savonarola's reign or his rule was ordained by God, if it's the correct, right thing and heaven wants it that way, why are we poor fairly suddenly? And why are people going hungry in the streets? And before long, everyone knows that before long, famine will lead to disease or a plague or something. It's not looking good. It's not looking like this is what the heavens want after all. And then it isn't too long before Savonarola's faction get a Gonfalonier into office, and he reverses as much as he can, and Savonarola is sort of back in favour. But the back of his authority has been broken, really, and things in Florence descend into sort of fairly open street fighting, factional street fighting. One of the things that a lot of people didn't like that garnered Savonarola a lot of enemies is that, like all sorts of revolutions, you have to keep it going, like any sort of Bolshevik or Soviet or communist revolution. You can't just have the revolution, then it's over, then we're all good. You'll have to constantly keep looking out for reactionaries and subversives and people that are looking to reverse the revolution you've just happened. So, yeah, oppression is the name of the game. And, you know, Savonarola sort of had to start dealing with that. I mean, it was hard baked into that sort of thing. I mean, in other words, he has gangs of thought police. Savonarola puts together gangs, they're always described as youths, young men, quite literally roaming the streets, being the thought police. So one, sort of extorting money out of people. And if women aren't being modest enough, a bit like Sharia police, if you're showing too much flesh, they'll tell you to go home and put more clothes on, or maybe even beat you up on the street. If you're doing anything they don't really like, if you're sort of doing something too effeminate, or you've been accused of sodomy or something, they'll beat you up, maybe beat you to death, just right there on the spot. If you're doing or saying anything they don't really like, you're in very real and immediate trouble. Well, now, that sort of society, that sort of informal society, again, also, you're encouraged to inform on your friends and neighbours to them as well. That's really quite repressive. And people, obviously, didn't like it. And so that gets dialed up towards the end of Savonarola's time in power. And there's even a vote in the actual city hall whether we should expel Savonarola, because everyone can see that the very fabric of Florentine civil society is falling apart. There's these gangs of thought police, and there's sort of rioting. There's street gangs, street violence kind of all the time. And so everyone, whether you're on Savonarola's side or not, thinks, just, is this for the best? Even if I agree with Savonarola, might it not be best for Florence if we exile him, at least for a while, let things calm down? And they have a vote on that, and Savonarola very, very narrowly, I think by maybe one or two votes, escapes being sort of formally, legally exiled by Florence. But once that happens, he realises that he's sort of holding on by the skin of his teeth. And so his only real option is to go harder, if anything. And so he does, and he starts doubling down on everything he's always said, particularly going after the papacy itself and the Pope, Alexander VI, Rodrigo Borgia. And he just starts saying openly that the Pope should be replaced, removed. Now, no Pope is going to like that at any time. Medieval popes obviously won't stand for that for one moment. Rodrigo Borgia, of course, is going to come down on you like a ton of bricks. Well, you would think that, but where Savonarola is sort of quite powerful and the things he says does not fall on deaf ears all over Italy, all over Europe, it looks like Rodrigo Borgia, like Lorenzo the Magnificent, isn't willing in the first instance just to have Savonarola, say, assassinated or just kidnapped and taken to Rome and put in a dungeon. He's not prepared to do that right away. Despite the fact that Savonarola is, you know, absolutely guilty of sedition and, well, certainly heresy. But Rodrigo Borgia does send a letter to Florence, to Savonarola, saying, look, come to Rome. I'm not an unreasonable man. If you come to Rome, we can have a sensible discussion about everything. And in the meantime, stop preaching, stop doing sermons for now. Come to Rome. We'll discuss it in person and we'll take it from there. We're both reasonable men, aren't we? Now, everyone knew that that almost certainly was a trap. Savonarola certainly just said, oh, no, like, no way. I'm too ill. I can't know. Sick note. I'm too ill. I can't go. It's not far from Florence to Rome at all, really. I can't do that. I'm too ill. And no thanks. So, Rodrigo, you would almost certainly disappear into the Castel Sant'Angelo, or into a papal dungeon of some type, and never be heard from again. Probably. If you're lucky. If not, just immediately killed. So the Pope at this point, instead of just going mad and putting the Roman Inquisition on the case and trying to abduct him or kill him, again, just sends another letter saying, no, okay, look, I get that you're suspicious, but no, seriously, come talk to me and we'll talk this out. But in the meantime, shut your mouth. In the meantime, stop doing sermons. And Savonarola seems to have blinked at least a tiny bit at that. And he stops doing sermons, but not for long, only for sort of a few months. Then he starts again. He keeps doing lots of writings, which get published and reprinted. And he says just openly things that the Pope, he says of the Pope, quote, thou art in error. You don't just say that about to the Pope. You don't just say you are wrong. The Pope is supposed to be infallible. He's supposed to sort of never be wrong. And if you do think he's wrong, and you wanted to say so openly, publicly, you'd have to couch it in very, very, very delicate language, sort of very, very vaguely, delicately hint at the possibility that maybe there might be some sort of outside possibility that he's wrong. You don't just say, thou art in error. He accuses Rodrigo Borgia of simony. Again, basically, the buying and selling of ecclesiastical office. And that even Borgia himself essentially bought the papal diadem, that he bribed his way into being the Pope. Now, Savonarola must have known by doing all this sort of thing, he's only going to bring down more and more trouble on his own head. He's goading the Pope. In late 15th century Italy, you don't goad the Pope. It's not a good idea, especially one like Rodrigo Borgia. He's got armies, and you in Florence haven't got much of an army. If the Pope wants to come and get you, he's going to be able to. So Savonarola must have thought, there's all sorts of times in history, aren't there, when someone's painted themselves into such a corner, maybe like Hitler in the Führerbunker. There's many examples, aren't there, that you know it's sort of over with. You know it's very, very difficult or probably almost impossible that you're going to get out of this. And so you're really acting for the stage of history. Everything you do and say from that point onwards is purely for posterity. And so we get to that point in February 1497, where there's a festival going on where the Florentines will quite often dress up in masks and costumes, put on wigs and things, and have a big street party, a citywide sort of street party and that sort of thing. But Savonarola has sent his gangs of youths, the type of 15th century thought police, he'd sent them door to door to gather up people's vanities, their nice things, their ornaments, and that they should rid themselves, purge themselves of their own vanities and throw them on a giant bonfire. And one account at the time describes them as, quote, wigs, false beards, masks, costumes, jars of lipstick, cards and dice, mirrors and perfumes, all manner of clothing and jewellery, books and drawings, busts and portraits of Florentine beauties. And the flames rose up. The people burst out singing the Te Deum, a type of ancient sort of monastic Gregorian chant type thing. They're singing in exaltation, accompanied by the sound of trumpets and ringing bells. End quote. So the thing about the bonfire of the vanities, they did another one a few months later. The thing about it is it's not necessarily a moment in time that's really, really sad. I and a lot of people look back on it as sad because people like Botticelli threw masterpieces on the fire. These sort of priceless, unique works of art. Jewels, book burning, books. The burning of books is never usually great. Not always the worst thing in the world, but usually it's not great. in this instance, it wasn't necessarily great. Great drawings, sort of unique drawings by great artists, were just destroyed. Even mirrors, that it's too vain to own a mirror. Probably going a bit far, isn't it? Perfumes, if you try and disguise your natural smell, that's vain. God doesn't want that. Destroy that. It's a bit Taliban, isn't it? It's a bit ISIS, a bit going a bit too far. Lipstick. Cards and dice, you know, any gambling, any games really, again, a bit like ISIS, even gaming is having fun and having nice things really at all is ungodly. Burn it. Do away with it. Otherwise, your soul is in peril. Otherwise, Jesus won't let you into heaven. And as I say, for them at the time, for a lot of people, it wasn't sad. It was joyous. They were singing in joy about it. It's an act of piety. Botticelli willingly threw some of his idolatrous, in inverted commas, idolatrous pagan paintings on the flames. Botticelli became a type of disciple of Savonarola. He completely did a 180, where he was sort of leading the charge in the Lorenzo the Magnificent days of painting sort of semi-pornographic Venuses, the goddess of love. He's now throwing them on the fire. Michelangelo, as you know, lived many, many decades after this. And he said he'd never forget Savonarola and what he said. And it really spoke to him. It absolutely spoke to him. He didn't hate it. Lots of people agreed with what Savonarola was doing. And Savonarola's rhetoric, if anything, just got more hardline. He said, quote, "The church is now a vainglorious harlot. It's a prostitute church that's shameless. It's full of idolaters. It's guilty of simony. It's lower than a beast, a monster of abomination." The Pope, end quote. The Pope's not going to let you say stuff like that and get away with it. It's just not happening. So where Borgia had been, you know, like, let's talk. Let's talk Turkey here. Let's work something out. Let's do a deal. He's like, okay, no. You're excommunicated. You're not a real Christian anymore. And Florence, if you don't hand him over forthwith, I shall put the entire city of Florence under interdict. And you'll all be staring down the barrel of being excommunicated. Every last man jack of you. I'm not playing about anymore. You know, I'm not having that. And when Savonarola himself gets wind that he's going to be excommunicated or has been excommunicated, he just doubles down again. At this point, when you've painted yourself into such a corner, a theocratic corner, you haven't really got many other options. And Savonarola's saying stuff like, "The Pope's got no authority to excommunicate me. He's not even a real Pope. He bought his office through simony, so he's not real. I know best. I excommunicate him, if anything." He says anyone that tries to excommunicate Savonarola are themselves excommunicated. He says the Pope is, he just says now the Pope is anathema. Yeah, you're excommunicated. How do you like that? How do you like me now? So the Pope does place all of Florence under an interdict, and even the authorities in Florence realise, oh, we've crossed the line, or rather we've allowed Savonarola to really cross the line here. Again, remember, we can't stand against the papal armies if it came to that. So they sort of, they don't exactly arrest Savonarola yet, but they keep him quiet and they don't really let him do sermons. But Savonarola keeps writing. His writings can still get out. And he says things like, quote, "The church is polluted. It's teeming with abomination. Alexander is no pope. He purchased his papal seat with simony. He is no Christian and does not believe in God." You can't really double down any harder than that, can you, really? There's nowhere else to go than that. So eventually, by this stage, the powers that be in Florence, have the ones that are anti-Savonarola, sort of get the upper hand. With all this, Savonarola's following and authority, his hardline supporters become more hardline, but a lot of his following leave him because they realise, you know, I don't want to be burnt at the stake for heresy. You know, if and when a papal army turns up, if it comes to that, I don't want to be killed. So I'll probably start siding with Savonarola's enemies, or at least just keep quiet. And so eventually, even though it's sort of a fairly well-balanced power dynamic, Savonarola's enemies inside Florence do get the upper hand to the point where they can arrest him. And they do. And they can't decide, at least to begin with, they can't decide exactly what to do with him. The Pope says, oh, okay, you've arrested him. Send him to Rome. Send him to Rome immediately. I need to have a discussion with him, or the Inquisition really need to have a conversation with Friar Savonarola. But the Florentines say, no, we'll deal with it. The Pope's not happy with that, but he sort of allows it. He sends a couple of legates, papal legates, to Florence, sort of help oversee things, or at least have eyes and ears in the room, so to speak. And they decide they'll put Savonarola through an ordeal of fire, which is quite a medieval thing. You have to walk across white-hot coals, and if you're innocent, your feet won't be burnt. If what you've said is truly ordained by God, he will protect you, and your feet won't be burnt. But if your feet are, you know, melted, then you are lying all along, and then we'll carry on with a full execution of you. So, but an ordeal by fire. And there's all sorts of wranglings over exactly when they're going to do this and how it's going to work. And Savonarola has a proxy or an alternate to do it for him. One of his followers, another monk, one of his like second or third in command guy, is going to do it on behalf of Savonarola, so he doesn't have to do it himself. That alone, right there, that loses him tons of confidence in his followers. Loads of his followers see that and they're like, that's odd. We kind of need Savonarola to do it himself. That's what it's all about. Why are you using a proxy? Why are you letting someone else do it in your stead? That's really weird and we don't trust you now. And you get why. You can see why people thought that. You know, it's kind of obvious. And there's all sorts of wranglings and they decide that we're going to get two guys to do it. One who's the pro Savonarola faction and one from the other faction in the city, and they're both going to have an ordeal by fire, and we'll see who God favours more. And so they set it all up again in the Piazza della Signoria, the central square in Florence, just outside the Palazzo Vecchio. I've sat there myself on a lovely sun-kissed afternoon having some drinks and lunch, and it's a very, very lovely place. It's hard to think that lots and lots of executions and killings and all sorts of strife and rioting and horrors have gone down in that place. Because right now it's just a tourist's dream. But all sorts of stuff have gone down in that piazza. And so when the day arrives that they're going to have this sort of double ordeal of fire, again, there's lots of arguing over exactly how it's going to happen. Whether things like whether they're allowed to wear certain robes. They're accusing each other that they've put spells on these robes that might make them immune to fire. And one of them wants to carry a cross while he's doing it. And the other side says, no, you can't do that. That's not fair. Or both have crosses, or then neither of you will. And then once we've taken you away from the square and put new robes on you, which we're sure haven't got spells on them to make them fire retardant, then you can't go near Savonarola again because he might charm it again, so we can't do that. And anyway, all this sort of arguing and wrangling goes on all day, literally all day long, until nightfall happens and the powers that be decide it's too late, we can't do it now, it's off, at least for today. Now overnight, literally overnight, that night, confidence in Savonarola's faction kind of collapses. You know, for a start, we really needed you, Savonarola, to be doing the ordeal of fire yourself. You weren't prepared to do that. That's weird and suspicious, massively. Now the appointed day has come and gone and you haven't done it. For whatever reason, you haven't gone through with it. We don't really trust you anymore. And if anyone's going to get our city invaded by the Pope and a lot of us killed, it's you. You're the problem. You're the problem now. So the next day, there's a little bit of street fighting, but basically the anti-Savonarola faction, the Mad Dogs, they attack the building that Savonarola is being held in. And as I say, there's some small amount of fighting, but it's over fairly quickly. And the powers that be have got Savonarola and his inner entourage in their hands, arrested. And so they put him on trial, but it is a 15th century trial. So it's not anything like a trial as we would know it, out in the open and fairness with prosecutors and defence attorneys and anything like that. No, they put him under torture. Him and two other guys, his two closest confidants, his second and third in command, if you like, they're all tortured multiple times to get confessions out of them. That's the way it was. One of them just confesses to anything they say immediately. The other one refuses to, which is very, very rare. Nearly everyone breaks under torture, if not almost immediately. After not too much torture, nearly or practically everyone breaks. But to never ever give in or break or admit to doing anything wrong or admit to the crimes that they're saying you're guilty of, to just refuse to under any duress, is extremely rare. Anyway, one of Savonarola's second-in-commands does that, which is remarkable. But Savonarola himself, after not too long of an ordeal, i.e. torture, he confesses to his crimes of being sort of a false prophet and things. But then once they stop torturing, he takes it back, he recants. Joan of Arc did a similar thing. Under torture, you say, yeah, whatever you say, I'm guilty of. I agree, I'm guilty of it. But then they stop putting you under incredible amounts of pain and you sort of regain your reason or your conviction. And you say, no, I only said all of that because you were putting me under torture. So they go through that rigmarole with Savonarola three times. And in the end, that is enough for the authorities, the Florentine and papal authorities. That's enough for them on paper to now just execute you and kill you. So that's what they do. Him and his two buddies are strung up, hung, basically, in the main square, again, the Piazza della Signoria in the middle of Florence. They're hung up slowly, not a long drop that just breaks your neck and you're instantly killed, but you're left there to strangle. And boys were allowed to throw stones at them, you know, quite humiliating, whilst you're being strangled to death in front of everyone. Also, people are throwing stones at your face. And then they died. And then their bodies were burnt. Some say Savonarola was burnt alive at the stake. No, he was killed first, hung first. Then they burnt their bodies. And the ashes they threw in the Arno, which is the river that runs through Florence. So there'd be nowhere for their martyrs' graves could never be anywhere for an opposition to congregate. You know, like throwing Bin Laden's body in the sea. There's no tomb, there's no grave that people can then venerate. Well, and so that happened on the 23rd of May, 1498. And so that is really the rise and fall of Savonarola. Now, just a quick few things to say in hindsight, looking back on it. You know, some people thought he was on the right track, at least to some extent. The Protestant Reformation, about 20 odd years in the future, a lot of them thought he absolutely had the right idea to think that Rome and the papacy were antichrists, that they were profoundly wrong, that they were doing Christianity badly. Martin Luther, said that Savonarola was a saint. The historian, the 20th century historian Will Durant, said that he was like an ancient martyr. Quote, Savonarola is the Middle Ages surviving into the Renaissance. That Savonarola was a man out of time, really. He was more like a 4th or 5th century early Christian martyr, absolutely prepared to keep doubling down until you're executed. After Savonarola's time controlling Florence, it had a period of 20 years, a little under 20 odd years, of being a republic again, controlled in various ways, in part by Machiavelli and Pierre Soderini. Again, they had another bit of a golden age, mini golden age, under Soderini. Soderini was the Gonfalonier for life. Under that period, where Machiavelli was being a puppet master, that's when Michelangelo creates the David and things. They've got rid of the Medici, they've got rid of a bit of a nutcase like Savonarola, and they can have their republic again, at least for a while. But Machiavelli said that he was like, again, like an ancient prophet, but a prophet without arms, without an army. That even biblical prophets really need a sword, metaphorically. You need a sword in hand. You need an army to make your regime stick. And Savonarola never had that. You know, Machiavelli thought that Savonarola was right. He was correct. If only he'd had more than his small gangs of thought police. If only he'd had a big, powerful army. Perhaps things might have been different. Well, so there you go. I hope you've enjoyed that story. I think it's a fascinating one. If it has piqued your interest, do go and read or listen to more. I think the life of Savonarola is absolutely fascinating and people like him. Next time I will do that overview, 300 odd years worth, of the Medici family.